As a pedestrian, you see headlights, but that doesn't mean the driver sees you. When walking at dawn, dusk, or after dark, make sure to be seen by oncoming traffic. Walk facing traffic. Wear light-colored, light-reflective clothing. Carry a bright light so drivers can see you. Use crosswalks. See and be seen. Pedestrian safety. It's no accident.
And it's also Halloween, so be especially careful when driving around. You never know who's going to be walking in the streets. It's just about 6 o'clock. You're listening to WUSB Stony Brook, broadcasting at 90.1 FM, 107.3 FM, and all throughout the planet on WUSB.FM. The time is 6 o'clock, time on a Tuesday for Off the Wall. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Halloween night, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes. Hi, I'm here. on Halloween.
No boo, no sound effect, nothing.
Ooh, spooky.
See, okay,
Halloween.
That's all I asked for. Yeah, yeah. Count Floyd, here on the FM Airwaves. You're good. A little too good.
Am I done yet?
I think you are. Yeah. I think you're finished. In fact, I also think our theme is finished because we have so much to get to tonight. So we have to start with the next theme.
Obviously.
Yes, it's once again, and for one of the last few times, another segment of Films of the Year That Was, where Kyle and I journey back into time, though we're not really going back much in time, to see all the Academy Award-winning films that have been made, the Best Picture, because we only have so much time. Best Picture for domestic, Best Picture for international. And today we are up to 2021, and there's only one more year after that because they decided the year afterwards. So this year they decided 2022. Anyway, so we talked about the domestic film last week, and this week we're talking about the international film, that being a three-hour Japanese epic called Drive My Car. How would you describe this one, Kyle?
Doraibu Ma Car.
Okay, that's not what I meant.
My Car.
I don't mean for you to speak it in the language. I mean for you to describe, in the limited time that we have, the film.
It was beautiful. It was shot in Hiroshima, a very stirring, beautiful Japanese landscape. And it is about a director, a theater director, who has a screenwriter wife or partner that they work together on these productions. They're working on a production called Uncle Vanya, and she subsequently passes away.
Spoiler alert, by the way.
This, his back and forth commute thereafter, doing his work, surrounds this interesting space in a vehicle, mm-hmm. and the story goes from there.
What kind of vehicle is it? He has a special vehicle, and it's left-hand drive,
right.
too,
it's
which
a,
is
a,
the opposite of what everybody else drives in Japan, so that was kind of confusing.
It's a Saab 900 turbo.
Wow. Do you know that they don't make Saabs anymore? There's a plane company, I believe, but I don't think they make cars anymore.
I don't think that's entirely true, okay, but that's a divert.
I read it on the internet, so maybe it's not true.
Well, there's a lot going on.
It's not important. Let's move on with the film.
They exist in one form or another, and they make vehicles. Basically, this car, actually, I learned originally in the original version of, before it was filmed, was yellow in a convertible. This was not a convertible. It was bright red, and that was done to complement or contrast with the landscape in Japan, which has a bit of sometimes overcast and universal lighting sort of look. But that production was incredible. The overall look.
What
but
was the
story?
Plot?
Was
what was
interesting.
The damn plot of the film? Because that was kind of hard to get going. Because as soon as you got used to one story, it just ended or shifted. It was a very weird narrative. And what you expect, I guess this is good, what you expect to have happen doesn't happen, and it goes a completely different direction, and there's red herrings that are thrown in that don't really go anywhere, like people coming down with certain, like, you know, dramatic diseases, and okay, so how are they doing? Never mentioned again.
Right. I think the critical reception, I was looking for a summation and what were to draw out of it, but and reading a lot of the responses and reviews in the write-up here, it's about what I thought. People talk about it as engrossing and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is quite a dramatic ride, but it is and also characterized as something where you're talking about acceptance and this you know, dealing with loss and changes and so forth. And so,
The interesting thing is they're putting on this production. They're putting it together. We saw a couple of productions. We saw the end of Waiting for Godot, and Uncle Vanya.
They start with that.
But the Uncle Vanya is interesting because they're putting that together. But it's a really interesting story because it's done in an international way where every character is speaking a different language, including one person who's signing. And that's interesting because we saw Coda the week before, which is all about signing. And now here we see somebody who is signing in Korean. and speaking to somebody else who's talking, I believe, Mandarin and Japanese and different languages. So it's just interesting to see a production put together like that. It's kind of inclusive, kind of international, and very, very different.
Yes, I was going to speak to that. That language aspect was fascinating. And that lends to the complexity of the actual story. And you're kind of left with some gaps and basically room for interpretation and coming away from it. There was like some details at the end, as minor as like a scar that you might have not noticed had changed.
It was a
big part of one of the characters. In fact, the driver of this director, because he practices lines while he's commuting against a tape that his now eventually deceased wife.
Well, it's already spoiler alert, but since his wife has passed away, she had already recorded one part of the play.
Exactly.
And he is supposed to practice by reading back his lines. I'm not sure how they record that and get the timing just right, but it's kind of interesting. He's driving in his car, or he's being driven in his car, and he's talking back to the tape, and that is how he gets better at his role.
Absolutely. And the driver become friends and share their stories and in fact travel around and he visits a place that was meaningful to the driver and her story, and eventually she, I believe, takes ownership of the car. So there's a lot to take in with the whole story, but it is really, really kind of heartfelt and just shows the crazy dynamics in life and people's idiosyncrasies and processes as artists, and they can be kind of wacky and maybe out from the outside not be something that you would think are a part of being in that profession. But there was just a lot of really interesting aspects of performing here as well.
Did it need to be 3 hours long?
You know, well, I think the way we watched, we gave ourselves a little bit of an intermission deliberately because of that, and that helped.
Yes.
Had we been stuck somewhere and crammed into some seat in a crowded place, I don't know if I could have,
I'm not sure there would have been a crowded place.
Well, imagine a film festival or when it had come out and was being considered. It would be a real investment, mm-hmm, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But this, it really looked fantastic, and
it looked great.
I was happy to go along for the ride and fill in those gaps and try to make sense of it and feel the kind of toil that the protagonist was going through and sharing with this other character.
So, Drive My Car, the best international film for 2021 at the Academy Awards. You know, it's getting kind of sad hearing that sound because I'm going to hear it two more times.
Well, they're going to continue to make films.
That's true, but the series is going to slow down substantially. Well, actually, it already was on hiatus for a year and a half when our transmitter blew up, but, you know, we knew this was going to happen when we started in 1929. We knew eventually we'd get to whatever year we were at now, and that's what's happening.
Wow. True, yeah, it is actually, I mean, when you put it in those sort of discrete terms, mm-hmm, but there's things we could do. Maybe we look at a different aspect and go through history again or go back in time.
You want to do Best Director? We could do Best Director because that's a whole different series of films.
And go in reverse order or something?
Well, we can go whatever order we want, but sometimes the Best Director is also the best film, but oftentimes it's not. Yeah. Or we could go to just the British Awards, you know, or maybe make it challenging and pick a country we don't speak the language. Huh? We can do that.
Or the worst films for me, just the ones that are paying.
Or just wall-to-wall Bollywood. We could do that.
Okay. All right.
All right. So there is something in the future.
We have options.
We're not sure what it is, but you, our listener, you're the victim here. All right. So serves as a nice interlude for us to dive into the events of the day, which are really no better than the events of last week. unfortunately. This world, I gotta tell you, I'm losing a lot of my faith that we're gonna figure out how to work things out. Maybe we will. I don't know if it's gonna be anytime soon or in our lifetimes. Just today, oh my God, this is just awful news. In the Middle East conflict, which just continues to ramp up and get more and more out of control, there was a Washington Post headline that just came over a couple of hours ago, saying that Israel had struck a refugee camp, killing and injuring hundreds of people, and added as an afterthought, Israel said it killed a senior Hamas leader. That was the objective. And apparently killing and wounding hundreds of people was simply a side effect of that. And I just, you know, seeing something like that, and that, you know, that is in a headline and it has been verified by Israel now. This is unlike the hospital incident a couple of weeks ago. Seeing that, I realized, you know, this is on a level beyond what any of us are used to. I mean, look at it this way. If we knew that a senior al-Qaeda leader was hiding in one of the most sacred temples in Jerusalem, and we blew the whole thing up and killed a few hundred people, that's cool, right? We got the guy. That's the important thing. That's what matters. Huh? No? We killed the wrong people? What, the building matters more? What did I do wrong? Tell me what I did wrong. I thought I was doing the right thing by blowing up the bad guy. And yeah, having hundreds of people as casualties, that's acceptable, right? Or is it only acceptable when certain people are doing it or when certain people are being killed? I just want to know what the rules are. Because I'm hearing all kinds of different things. But what I heard today was sickening. And I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more about that. I'm sure we're going to see a lot more reactions to that. And we cannot be surprised when that happens. I'm really sick of being surprised or being told that I'm supposed to be surprised because, you know, none of this reaction really surprises me all that much. It wasn't hard to predict that something like this would happen at some point. And that it would go the way it's going right now. And there's a lot of ugliness around us in the world, a lot of ugliness around us locally. We're seeing it all come out. Let's start with what's happening at Cornell University. Cornell University police are investigating a series of anti-Semitic threats made against the school's Jewish community in online posts over the weekend. Their president, President Martha Pollack, said in a statement Sunday, earlier today, a series of horrendous anti-Semitic messages threatening violence to our Jewish community and specifically naming 104 West, which is the home for the Center for Jewish Living, was posted on a website unaffiliated with Cornell. The online messages surfaced Sunday and included threats to shoot Jewish students at the 104 West building, which houses their kosher dining hall, and messaging encouraging others to harm Jews. That's according to the school's student newspaper. Now, I understand they made an arrest today, which is a good thing. But this sort of thing, you know, we're seeing it increase. There's swastikas out in Montauk. Now, you know, this might be some idiot just painting a swastika that can barely spell his own name. But the hatred, you don't need to be literate to communicate that effectively. And it spreads. It spreads like a cancer because it is a cancer. And hatred and death and injustice, breeding grounds for this kind of thing. And it just keeps getting worse. And it's not limited to one group of people. It's not caused by one group of people. It's something that's in all of us. And we need to take a step back and start really raising our voices here. Enough already. You know, I was very critical of the people that jumped out the day of or the day after the October 7th terrorist attacks in Israel, celebrating or calling for a Palestinian independence and end of occupation and all that. Things I agree with, but the timing was just terrible. And the lack of mention of the atrocities of Hamas was unforgivable. And I say, you know, anyone who was part of that, that has yet to condemn what Hamas did, just stay out of the conversation. You're not helping anyone. But now, you know, we've advanced a few weeks, and the amount of people killed in Gaza far exceeds what the terrorist attack accomplished, is a horrible word to use, if numbers are all that matter. Because now we're approaching 10,000 people killed in Gaza, including well over 3,000 children. Every week I come on and I say another 1,000 kids have been killed. Now, the most recent thing that we do here in this country is say that, well, those numbers come from Hamas. And you notice in all the papers now, they're saying that. They're saying Hamas-run health organization says this. Okay, fine. So now we're saying that we don't believe that the number of people killed is the number of people killed. So what numbers do we believe? What numbers do we get? How do we get these numbers? The video we're seeing, is that real? Or are these actors? Or is this file footage? What are we saying here? Because I think those numbers are probably pretty accurate. They always have been in the past. The United Nations just buried something like 60 of their employees in Gaza. The United Nations! And, you know, looking at how Israel has attacked the United Nations as if they were the enemy is really cause for concern. A lot of concern. They are out of control. Nobody is telling them to stop. Everyone is just saying, oh, they have the right to defend themselves. Yes, the right to defend themselves. This is not defense anymore. This is a massacre. And nobody has the right to do that. Period. So plenty of people are saying that now. And now is the time to be heard. And now is the time to raise our voices and say enough already. And stop this madness. Yeah, I know they want to get every last Hamas member. They're not going to do that. And you know what? Their fall fund drive, well, their membership drive is going just great. Yeah, because these actions really inspire a lot more people to join up. So maybe rethink the tactics. Of course, you know, that's not what Netanyahu wants. He wants more of this. He wants as much war, devastation, hatred as possible. Hey, when's the last time you saw a few 100,000 people marching against him? That's pretty much come to an end. He'll get whatever he wants. Unless the people stand up and stop this. Of course, that's only one small step in what needs to be done. There is so much still that needs to be fixed over there. And we're much further behind, thanks to Netanyahu, thanks to Trump, thanks to ignoring the Palestinians over the past decade. We are so much further behind than where we should have been. One thing is for sure, the people who helped set this up should not be the people that plan things down the road. No Netanyahu, certainly no Trump, and nobody who basically has helped put the Palestinians in this position. And definitely no Hamas. And that's going to be tough. That's going to be really, really tough. But I think the only solution is an international solution, which is not going to be easy. But the people who have been running it so far have not done a good job. And, you know, everyone says how great the Israeli army is. I don't think they're that great. I think they're pretty bad, actually. Because if the only way they can kill their enemy is to kill a few hundred people at the same time, that's not efficiency. That's not really meeting the objectives. That's becoming something that I don't think anyone ever had in mind from the beginning.
Scattershot?
I just think it's careless. It's, you know, treating people like they're subhuman. And I know that is not what the state of Israel was founded upon at all, if there's anything left of it at this point. Mark my words, the threat to the state of Israel is more the likes of Netanyahu than the likes of Hamas. You know, terrorism is a fairly simple thing to grasp, but this sort of thing that changes who you are and makes the unacceptable palatable, that is a lot harder to understand than to get through.
I agree with a lot of what you said. It's,
so do I.
No, those are great, great things, and they're all worth thinking about deeply. And I liken, like, the recent invasion with Ukraine, comparing that. I think in the aftermath, the idea was to defend that, not go in and try to settle scores for, you know, atrocity for atrocity, and then some. And that was, I think, the pause that we were hoping for, or some kind of resolution. But again, like you said, the history, it's like, how many billions over the years, how much has been spent, how much blood and diplomatic summits and meetings, and it's been typified in over my existence by never being solved and never being peaceful ever.
Mm-hmm.
It's been in perpetuity. It has been violent, and I don't have much to contribute. The co-signing for this, and just the result, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The long-term result just is very, very hard. It's elusive, and the heavy-handedness, I think, it's really hard to watch.
Yeah. Well, you know,
like you said, not be surprised by it.
You need international law. You need to follow that. And Israel has not done that. They have ignored it. They have thumbed their noses at a call to end illegal settlements, driving Palestinians out of their land that they've held for a very long time. And yeah, I'm not going to dig up history here, because first of all, I don't understand a whole lot of it. There is so much of it, but you know, I am pretty certain that claiming that your people came from someplace, you know, a couple of thousand years ago, while impressive, is not enough to get somebody kicked off of their land that they've lived in for 100 years or even 50 years. You know, it's a significant amount of time, and you need to work something else out, is basically my simplistic way of saying this. Because simply treating people as if they're trespassers in their own homes, and just kicking them out and being violent, that's not how you make good neighbors. That's one of the first things I was told when I moved into my house. Don't do that. And it's good policy. It's really good policy. It has not been followed. And in no means am I not looking at the horrors that have come from the other side as well. But you have to understand what living in those conditions does to people. You know, you put somebody in a prison yard, they're not going to come out a Rhodes Scholar, you know. It's well, they could, I guess, but it's unlikely. And your view on life is going to be a bit jaded. And unfortunately, that's what so many kids, and you look at every single picture of Gaza, and there are kids in every single shot. And for some reason, they always have a smile on their faces, almost always, it seems. And that is the real tragedy here. That anyone can look at that scene and say, yeah, nothing we could do. They shouldn't have been living where they live. They shouldn't have voted in Hamas, what, 20 years ago? A lot of these people weren't even alive 20 years ago. You can't blame them for that. You can't blame them for living on top of a Hamas tunnel. It's not like you get a choice. This is the prison that you have basically put them in. And there's no way out. You've got Hamas on one side. You've got the Israeli military on the other side. What kind of a hell is that? And, of course, you know, there are many other countries there that could be doing so much more. There's no question about that. Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and don't even get me started on Iran. So, yeah, it's hell. It's hell, and bringing more hell doesn't solve anything. So,
well, maybe the IDF can do some nice, you know, helpful things in the area. You know,
why are people raising money for the IDF? I don't. They're a well-stocked army, and the people are having bake sales for the damn military. That they don't need that. They really don't need that. What they need is to calm down a bit and to think this through, and come up with a decent plan. Look, if you actually do invade Gaza, I can't imagine the word quagmire is going to have to be redefined. All right, everything that happened to our troops in Iraq will happen tenfold. It's going to be terrible in an urban environment. And what is your plan for afterwards? Are you going to run the place? You think that's going to work out? No, it's not. It's time to talk with the world. That's what the world is for. Instead of ignoring it or thumbing your noses at it, it's not right. Meanwhile, because of our involvement in doing things like blocking ceasefires and basically telling Israel we have your back. It's not the back I'm worried about; it's the front I'm worried about. You know, it's what they're doing without anybody saying, "Yeah, you sure you want to do that?" Fall back here. FBI Director Christopher Wray said today the war between Israel and Hamas has led to a spike in threats against the United States, warning we are in a dangerous period as various terrorist groups look to leverage the conflict for their own causes. And that is a very real threat. The threat of international terrorism in the U.S. had largely subsided in recent years, particularly since the defeat of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. But senior American officials say Hamas's deadly October 7th attack on Israel has created a new dynamic with dangerous implications at home and abroad. The reality is that the terrorism threat has been elevated through 2023, but the ongoing war in the Middle East has raised the threat of an attack against Americans in the United States to a whole other level. Now, this is where I differ, because what Ray says is that Hamas's attack, which killed some 1,400 people in Israel, will serve as an inspiration, the likes of which we haven't seen since ISIS launched its so-called caliphate years ago. But he doesn't focus on the slaughter of nearly 10,000 Palestinians since then. Might that also be an inspiration, maybe even a greater inspiration, to target Americans who are helping this to happen? I think that that probably would enrage people a lot more, and I think that's what we're seeing in various places, including college campuses and train stations and streets and things like that. And, you know, most of those demonstrations are fine. Most of those demonstrations are people expressing themselves and their outrage. But within the demonstrations, I'd say within most of the demonstrations and maybe some entire groups of people, there is an ugliness. There is an anti-Semitism. There is hatred. There is violence. Look, we saw what happened in Dagestan. How many people even knew there was a place called Dagestan? Yeah, Dagestan is a part of Russia. It's mostly Muslim. And the other day they got wind that a plane had landed from Tel Aviv, and they thought that the thing to do was charge the plane or try to find passengers on the plane and do God knows what to them. Fortunately, they were able to stay out of the mob's way. Nobody got hurt except for some of the demonstrators. But they were basically saying they wanted the Jews. It was scary. It was really scary to see that unfolding. Now, you might say, well, they were after Israelis, but they were saying they were after the Jews. I mean, you know, at this point, words kind of get murky because, you know, the Israeli government refers to their citizens as Jews, and these people, I don't think, really cared one way or another. I think they were just out for blood. And the differences become extremely murky, and you see people being targeted because of it, of their faith, of their culture. And end of story. That's it. You're right back where we were 100 years ago. So this ugliness exists, and we have to acknowledge that, and we have to defeat that, all at the same time while standing up for justice. And fighting back and not simply following blindly. And, you know, I see a lot of people kind of falling into step without really questioning. You know, there's this phrase that you hear said, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And it's, you know, it's a nice slogan, but it basically means, if you look into it, the destruction of the state of Israel. I think most people who say that might not know that. But to assume everybody that says that is wishing for the death of the Jewish people, that's a bit of a step. And that's something that I think maybe education is better than condemnation at that point. So that we can get a little clarification here as to what exactly they mean. Because, you know, I see people saying on places like Twitter and Blue Sky and all that, when you chant that, you're chanting for the death of my family. And, dude, you live in Brooklyn, okay? I don't think anyone is chanting for the death of your family. But I understand why that is an important phrase to challenge and to perhaps shape in a way, because we certainly do need a solution. We certainly do need for Palestinians to be free, absolutely. But that does not mean the destruction of Israel. And if you can agree on those two things, then there's a conversation worth having. If either one of those causes a problem to you, again, sit this one out. Let people talk who can, you know, talk with each other, not at each other. There are some ads targeting some candidates in the election here in Nassau and Suffolk County that have been accused of being anti-Semitic. An ad paid for by the Nassau County Republican Committee depicts the likeness of legislator Josh Lavezin of Woodbury with fistfuls of $100 bills, his teeth elongated and yellowed, his nose enlarged, and a plume of smoke above his head that forms shadows in the shape of horns. All right, I don't know who the artist was that went to town on that, but come on, man, you must have known that wasn't going to land very well. There was another ad paid for by the New York State Republican Committee that shows the same candidate on the back of a dollar bill, accuses him of enriching himself and scheming to get ahead. Yeah, these are tropes. These are words that definitely land differently depending on who you aim them at. Now, Lafazan is a Jewish Democrat in a hotly contested 18th district race against Republican challenger Samantha Goetz. Another GOP mailer paid for by the state Republican committee targets Democrat John Kamen, who is seeking to reclaim the North Hempstead supervisor seat he held for 10 years. The ad shows Kamen with fistfuls of cash under the words high taxes and corruption. Kamen faces incumbent supervisor Jen DeSena, a registered Democrat running as a Republican in the election. Now, Democrats say the ads use hurtful, centuries-old tropes, linking Jewish people to money at a time of increasing reports of anti-Semitism and hate speech since the start of the Israeli-Hamas war. Republicans say the mailers were created without knowledge of candidates' religion or ethnicities and were meant to illustrate greed and corruption. Let me stop you right there, Republicans. You're telling me that you're running against someone in a hotly contested election and you don't know what their religion is? You just, weren't even curious? It's never been made public? Think you knew. I'm pretty sure you knew. Pretty sure you just let that one go. Lafson said, this is certainly not the first time I've faced anti-Semitism in my life, but it certainly is the first time I faced it in any campaign. Kamen, a deputy county executive in Suffolk, head of Suffolk's anti-Semitism task force, said the flyers are part of a larger effort by Republicans, and during a time of heightened sensitivity, we should be taking extra precautions not to cross those lines. I look at their entire approach as presenting an extremely negative and inappropriate campaign, adding an element of deeper dog whistles and tropes. It is unfortunately not surprising, but it is disturbing. Nassau GOP spokesman Mike Deary issued a statement calling the claims of anti-Semitism insincere and specious. The Republican Party has no knowledge of the religion that either of the candidates in question observe. I'm calling him on that one. Nor do we associate illustrations of greedy and corrupt politicians holding money with any ethnic group, race, or religion. Stop laughing, Kyle.
That's just general politician vibe.
Yeah, yeah. You have no idea what religion you are. Absolutely have no interest. But Lafazette and Kyman said they had heard from constituents who thought the ads were questionable and offensive. The newly redrawn 18th Legislative District and town of North Hempstead are home to large numbers of Jewish residents. It's not clear whether Lafazette and Kyman are the only two Democratic candidates targeted by the mailers. Nassau County Democratic Chairman Jay Jacobs said he was unaware of any others. He called the ads targeting the two men either recklessly negligent or motivated by the worst aspects of hate. It amazes me, with all that's going on in the world, that this is still something Republican candidates are resorting to in order to win elections. I think it's disgraceful. I think they need to think long and hard about where their moral center is. I think it's evaporating when they put out ads like this. Experts in anti-Semitism who reviewed the ads said they relied on longtime prejudices about Jewish people. Maurice Samuels is the director of Yale University's Program for the Study of Anti-Semitism, says it just taps into stereotypes of various anti-Semitic tropes of Jews possessing undue influence through money, Jews exerting control, and Jewish corruption. Ira Sheskin, a leading Jewish demographer and geography professor with the University of Miami, said most people looking at this would come to the conclusion that there is a kind of connecting of Jews with money grubbing here. You don't take someone who is Jewish and have them hold wads of cash. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you had, I really hesitate to draw the comparison here, but you had an African-American candidate holding, you know, a big watermelon above his head or something like that, we all know that was offensive. People say, oh, well, I didn't know that was something that upset people. Come on. This is the 21st century. I think we've all heard something. Hofstra University political science professor Richard Himmelfarb, registered Republican, by the way, said that Democrats were really going far afield here in charging anti-Semitism. I have seen dozens of overtly anti-Semitic statements, anti-Semitic acts, and anti-Semitic incidents in the last 2 weeks. Whatever is purported to be going on in these mailers wouldn't make the top 500 of things that I have seen as horribly offensive.
Oh, well, normalizing.
I guess you've got a high bar or you see an awful lot of this stuff. But top 500, that's not even the top 1% of what's out there right now. So you want to throw math, I can do that too.
And it's all too many, too much.
Hey, I got a mail. I mentioned this on the other radio show. And now it's big news, but not because of my other radio show. It's just other people got the mailer, I guess. But the Democrats sent out this voting mailer here in Suffolk County, which was incredibly boneheaded and stupid. It's labeled your personal vote history record. And right there on the front, it's a postcard. On the front, they have 3 years, 2020, 2021, 2022. And it says, you know, if you're good, it said voted, voted, voted under each year. If you missed a year, it says not voted. And they basically tell you that this is your personal vote history record, and telling people that this information is public, saying we will update your voting record after Election Day, after confirming whether you voted. I don't understand the need for this. It just seems hostile. It seems like Big Brother is watching you. And, you know, when I got this, I was really taken aback. It wasn't for any candidate. It was simply basically reminding you that they're watching. And I didn't appreciate even supporting their candidates. I didn't appreciate that. And I don't know who was behind it, but I would say a lot of Democratic votes in Suffolk County were probably lost because of that. So nice going already. Long Island has been in pretty bad shape. This sure doesn't help. I mean, I don't even know where to begin.
Well, speaking of scattershot, it just it's a random campaign. It's not something cohesive. So yeah, I guess now I'm more annoyed by it that other people have noticed, because it does make it look really bad. I thought maybe, you know, it was a small campaign or something like a one-off, but if it is really widespread and that's what the emphasis is, it really is a bad look. Like, the tenor of it is just not pleasant. You could be so much more, even to a fault, but exuberant and positive about getting out the vote, encouraging people to all the things, you know, update their address,
so do whatever
they
things.
Have to do.
So many good things
to,
out there.
To help other people register, help new voters, you know, all of the different things, dates, times,
representation, the environment, you know, green energy, paving the roads, you know, all the things that
well,
people are
yeah.
upset about.
Platform
yeah.
and policies and, you know, accomplishment.
I mean, I'm beside myself here because with all the craziness that Republicans have pulled out of their hats in the last couple of years, it should be a cakewalk, whatever that is, for Democrats to run roughshod over them in this coming election and the one next year. And they're not. They're having trouble. They're having trouble because they keep doing things like this or falling over themselves or saying stupid things or just not reaching out to the people in an effective way. And they really, really need to get their act together on this. They really need to. And there's only a week left to do that for this election. And I'm really worried about what could happen. All right, let's change it up because I'm kind of sick of this. Talk about mass shootings, all right? Oh, yeah, change the pace a little bit.
Something we're also not super chill about.
Almost a week now since the horrors in Maine. It used to be, you know, something like that would take up the whole show, but now we have to cram it in. 18 people killed in Maine because this guy snapped at his ex-girlfriend or something like that. And the thing that really bugs me, you know, it's not so much that he practically equaled the complete number of people killed in the state for a year. It's that they knew about this guy. They knew about this guy. The cops were sent to his home mere weeks before the massacres. Yeah, because he had two massacres in two different places. And the quote was, they were concerned he was going to snap and commit a mass shooting. You cannot get any more specific than that. This guy is going to snap and commit a mass shooting. And yet they weren't able to stop it. They weren't able to even talk directly to him. The responding sergeant from the sheriff's office was told when this guy answers the door at his trailer in the past, he usually does so with a handgun in hand, out of view from the person outside. The responding officer learned later in a letter from the Army that the soldier is concerned that this guy was going to snap and commit a mass shooting, as we quoted. In Maine, the laws are a little bit different than they are here. They don't have the red flag law, which has proven extremely effective. That being, if friends or family believe somebody is a danger, it's very likely they lose access to guns.
Temporarily,
but it's something. It's something. It's not enough, but it's something. And here we see how even that something would have been enough. It's not nearly enough overall, but to not even have that, to have law enforcement saying, yeah, this guy is a potential threat. He could commit a mass shooting. And to have that exact thing happen and law enforcement is unable to stop it. You know, I hope a lot of people go down for this. I really do. I hope a lot of people lose their jobs. I hope people go to prison for this because it's on them as well. No, they didn't pull the trigger, but they sure enabled it. And I include lawmakers in there that thought it wasn't important to have something as basic as a red flag law. This is the result of that. And we cannot let this simply fade into history and say, oh, well, there's another one. 18 people lost their lives. Families are destroyed. The trust of the community is destroyed. And the entire country is affected by this. We have to wake up. I am so sick of the selfishness of the gun lobby. Basically, I want my toys. I don't care who gets hurt. No, no more of this. There are ways, you know, I'm convinced there are technical solutions to this. Again, I'm naive. I don't know exactly what's involved, but I do believe we need to start thinking differently. And if it's not realistic for us to actually do something like other countries have done and ban certain types of weapons altogether, at the very least, we can take some steps. We can take some steps, maybe have some kind of RFID in guns that only allow them to work with the owners, you know, near their hands or whatever, or their fingerprints. Yeah, it sounds a bit Orwellian, I know. But, you know, it's a step. It's a way to let people keep what they hold so dear to them and also prevent it from falling into someone else's hands. And are there ways around it? Sure. But it's not quite so easy. Look, I don't know if this is a solution or even, you know, the most harebrained scheme. But we have to start thinking of something, because everything we're doing right now is not working.
I've been really interested in some kind of gun owner liability insurance mandate or requirement nationwide. It exists in a couple states. It should be it should complement all the other sort of practical things like IDs and red flags and stuff. But that, and also the manufacturers should create some kind of fund or victim compensation amongst themselves that once the immunity that they enjoy is repealed, will go towards medical expenses and preparedness, mass casualty preparedness, which takes a lot of supply and training and preparation for these hospitals. But picking up the bill, footing the bill for all of this, it's coming down to money. It's just business to the manufacturers and to the lobby, like you said. So I think we should just treat it as such and repeal that immunity and just make them start looking like a pile of cash. Like, they owe it. They owe it. They're making way too much money off all of this. Mm-hmm. And they're, I think, well able to come up with safer strategies. And if they don't do it voluntarily, I just think they should be, dissolved.
That only addresses new guns. What about all the ones that are out there already?
Exactly.
We need solutions for all of them. And we need to start thinking big.
It should be costlier for the people involved. And it's a little hard with insurance, but, I mean, because it's counterintuitive the way it would work. But I think there's got to be some kind of strategy where there's more responsibility.
60 Minutes had an interesting piece this week about the pandemic, about air quality and why that is such an important aspect to all of this, something that a lot of people didn't realize at first. A lot of scientists didn't realize. But what they did point out that I thought was really important, that needs to be underlined, is that the N95 masks worked. They helped. They didn't prevent everything. They're called N95s because they're at least 95% efficient at blocking airborne particles when you use them properly. But even masks as low as 80%, well, you still have some meaningful protection. The important thing is that I got out of this piece was that while we didn't know everything about the importance of air filtration, which is something that we have learned from this, the steps that we did take, some of them were kind of a waste of time, like, always wiping counters and things like that. But wearing the masks, keeping distance to a degree, and limiting contact, it was necessary. It did do something, and the community, the scientific community, acted on what they had. And they should not be chastised for that, because had they not acted, and had they not developed a vaccine as quickly as they did, the situation would have been so much more dire. And on that note, the interest for the latest COVID vaccine really seems to have fallen quite a bit, and that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing.
What's it down to, 80%?
Okay. 39% of residents of Nassau and Suffolk plan to get a vaccine. 15% said they already got the shot. I guess we're included in that. 25% do not plan to receive it. 22% are undecided or did not answer. So needs to be better than that. Needs to be at least above 50, hopefully a lot more than that. You know, to keep from getting something which is potentially deadly. And let's not forget how deadly this was. Millions of people died. Over a million people died in this country. Millions of people died around the world from COVID. And don't let yourself be talked out of that by anybody. Okay, running out of time here. Amityville School District is now suing over the ban on racist Native American mascots. One after another. School districts in Long Island are just saying, we want our racist mascots. Honestly, how hard is it? How hard is it to come up with a team name for your school that won't offend a Native American tribe? You know, you don't have to be the Warriors. I mean, you can be the Warriors if you never were Warriors with Indian headdress and all that. If you are associated with that, then obviously you can't keep calling yourselves the Warriors anymore. It's not hard. It really is not hard. Come up with a different name, grow up already, and set a good example for your kids. The Tuckahoe School District out east is planning to study the feasibility of constructing a high school following a request from the Shinnecock Nation. The school would have a curriculum designed in part to address and incorporate the history and culture of the Shinnecock people. They stressed the proposal is in the preliminary stages, and it will take years if it does get approved, but initial reaction from the community is very positive. And I sure hope that happens, because more understanding of your roots, your culture, it's such an important thing. So let's see that advancement happen.
That's exciting. I didn't know that was going on, but it reminds me of our trip up in the Yukon. We were walking along one of the paths, and they were doing an educational thing. I think they were showing how to prep skins or something. And I think it was a summer program based around a cultural center, not a school per se. But, yeah, if they can integrate that stuff into the curriculum, I had a lot of that in my younger days. And so to have that that actually serves the community that it applies to is spectacular. That's great.
We have to end, but I want to end on somewhat of a somber note, and that's the whole Buffy St. Marie story, where this Canadian icon, Native American or Indigenous icon, is being supposedly revealed as a phony, somebody who isn't actually Indigenous. And we don't really have time to get into it. It's a story that's still breaking up in Canada. But I did find this online survey from a site called TheBeaverton.com. Is Buffy St. Marie actually Indigenous? 6 extremely white people weigh in. They say, Melissa Jensen says, as in The Vampire Slayer, did I miss the season where they establish she's Native? Mercer Workman of St. John's says, God, I hope so. I added her to my Spotify after the BLM protest. Made me realize I only listen to white people, and I don't want to go through the bother of finding another Indigenous musician to soothe my conscience. Evelyn Graves McKenzie of Vancouver says she definitely is Indigenous, and I can say this with certainty because I chastise people for using the term spirit animal and make a point of looking solemn during land acknowledgments. Braden Fleck of Toronto said, either way, this will be great for a bit in my stand-up, which consists entirely of jokes about someone identifying as something. Buffy St. Marie of USA said, yes, she's Indigenous, absolutely, case closed. And Justin Trudeau of Ottawa says, let's keep our national attention on this one issue, since there isn't anything pertinent happening anywhere else in the world. Nothing more to say except our email address, otw@2600.com. Let's go out with a Buffy St. Marie piece.
Stay true to yourselves.
Good night, everyone.
Bye.